You're listening to an event podcast from the Brookings Institution. To get more in-depth analysis and commentary from our scholars, subscribe to the Brookings Cafeteria Podcast on iTunes, download on Stitcher, or find on our website at brookings.edu/BCP.
All right. Good afternoon. My name is Jim Ziliak. I'm a professor of economics and director of the Center for Poverty Research at the University of Kentucky. And I want to welcome you to this afternoon session on state policy choices. I think we had some incredibly stimulating conversations this morning with our three panels. Much like this social safety net, it's very disentangled one program from the other. It's difficult to disentangle topics from one panel to the other. So we heard a little conversation about states and some of the earlier panels today. And we're going to focus more on that this afternoon. States have long played a pivotal role in the design and administration of their welfare programs, but the 1996 reform opened a new chapter in the economics and politics of fiscal decentralization. Under AFDC, the primary levers at state discretion were the need standard, which determined income eligibility, and the payment standard, which determined benefit payment. Financing for the program was a federal-state matching grant, similar to that used by Medicaid today, with the federal share higher in lower-income states. With TANF, however, the funding mechanism changed to a fixed and nominal dollars block grant based on the state's caseload in the early 1990s. And with the changed funding formula came a dramatic increase in the scope of state choices, including new program eligibility criteria, such as work requirements, sanctions, and time limits, to name just a few. Importantly, states were also given great leeway in setting broad parameters in program design, such as what fraction of the federal block grant to allocate to cash assistance, and what fraction to in-kind assistance, and what populations to serve by the various cash and in-kind program components. The aim of this panel this afternoon is to assess how states perform with this new flexibility, and what lessons and takeaways we can garner in thinking about further reforms to TANF and to other programs in the safety net. Leading us in this discussion is a distinguished group of scholars, administrators, and policy experts. First to speak next to me is Gordon Berlin. Gordon is the president of MDRC, one of the nation's largest nonprofit and nonpartisan research evaluation firms. Gordon has decades of experience in human services policy, both as an administrator and as a scholar, authoring many influential reports and articles on welfare reform. Next to him is Robert Greenstein. Bob is the founder and president of the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. Bob's knowledge of the workings of the federal budget, including the whole range of anti-poverty and tax programs, is unparalleled. I think it's fair to say amongst poverty researchers of my generation that Bob qualifies as a rock star. Following Bob is Raquel Hatter. Dr. Hatter currently serves as Commissioner of Human Services in the state of Tennessee, an agency that serves over 2 million Tennesseans, including those participating in TANF and related social welfare programs. With a clinical background in mental health, she has led efforts to enact system change to better serve vulnerable individuals and families, both in Tennessee and in her former home in the state of Michigan, as well as nationally. Next to her is Don Winstead. Don has over 30 years of experience in state and federal service, first as a frontline caseworker, and most recently as Deputy Secretary of Florida's Department of Children and Families. He also served as Deputy Assistant Secretary for Human Services Policy at the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. Currently, he serves as the founder and principal of Winstead Consulting. Our final panelist, and Mike would say it should be me, being Ziliak rather than Wiseman, but Mike gets to be the end of the alphabet today. Our final panelist is Michael Wiseman. Mike is currently a research professor of public policy, public administration, and economics at the George Washington University and visiting scholar in the Administration for Children and Families in the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. He previously served on faculty at UC Berkeley and the University of Wisconsin and has published extensively in the areas of poverty and welfare, including state policy choices under welfare reform. Like the earlier panels, each speaker will provide a brief opening statement, followed by a moderated discussion, and concluding with questions from the audience. So without further ado, I'll turn the floor over to Gordon.
Great. Thanks, Jim. discretion.
It's on now.
It's on now. Okay, yeah. Sorry. So the TANF federal law is actually 50 separate state laws. And in the process of passing conforming legislation, four key issues really dominated the debate in each state. The first was how to frame the state's block grant and maintenance of effort response. What will be funded? What are they going to try to count against the MOE? Now, it's important to remember that the 1996 law, the caseloads were at an all-time high when it passed. The roaring 90s economy was accelerating. The EITC was expanding. And together, these forces practically ensured that states would be locking in the block grant at the peak period of the caseload, and really in their history. And the block grant's flexibility afforded states enormous discretion in how these dollars would be spent. Now, how did that work? Well, TANF's maintenance of effort provision was 80% of historic spending. So right away, states were given a 20% bonus. In addition, the MOE structure that replaced AFDC's dollar-for-dollar match was built around TANF's purposes. And that was provide assistance, end dependence, reduce out-of-wedlock births, promote marriage. And two of these, the last two, were really quite flexible. So thus, almost anything would count as MOE. The last two purposes have no income limits. The money doesn't have to be spent on the poor. And last, because there's no match, states can segregate how they pay for things, allowing them to skirt requirements that did not work out so well for them, things like the work requirement. So what was the result of this in the states? In 1997, 70% of the combined federal and TANF state MOE dollars went for basic assistance. By 2014, that figure had fallen to 26%. The core activities, child care, work activities, and of course basic assistance, combined totaled just 50% of TANF and MOE spending by 2014. And eight states spent less than 25% of their funds on these three categories, while five states spent more than 75%. And last, in 2014, states spent about 20% of their MOE TANF dollars on categories called other non-assistance and the category authorized under prior law. And this other non-assistance kinds of payments range from less than 1% in one state to more than 77% in another state. So in large measure, then, the block grant devolved into a form of revenue sharing for the states. I don't see how we can think about it in any other way. There was huge flexibility, and one result was there was no longer principally a cash assistance program for the poor. So what was the second issue? It was where to come out on time limits. Remember, they're the most controversial provision in the law initially. It included a 20% hardship exemption, and it did not apply to child-only cases. So right away, about 40% of the caseload was exempt. Not surprisingly, here again, policies vary dramatically from state to state. About half of TANF families live in states that rarely or never close families' cases because of time limits. On the other hand, a quarter of TANF families live in states that usually terminate benefits after 60 months, and another quarter or so actually have shorter time limits than that. Still, most recipients lost benefits for failure to comply with work requirements or eligibility requirements, not for reaching a time limit. I think the single most important role that time limits played initially was messaging. You couldn't visit a welfare office in those first few years without getting the sense that everyone, caseworker and client, understood welfare is ending. It's no longer an option. The third big category was the design of the cash assistance program, establishing the grant amount, eligibility requirements, the application process, whether there'd be a diversion program at the front door, whether to make work pay. Here, too, mind-boggling variation, especially if you care about horizontal equity. The cash grant amount in Mississippi is $170. It's $670-some in California and New York. A handful of states allow welfare recipients to keep some of their welfare grant as a supplement to low earnings. Actually, almost all of them did that. Still, the earned income disregards vary dramatically from zero in Arkansas to 75% in Illinois. And of course, it's important to keep in mind that inflation had really eroded the value of the grant. So that brings me to the fourth issue, which was what kind of welfare to work policy to implement. And here, TANF tied states' hands. It placed restrictions on the use of training and education, allowed job search but limited its use to 6 weeks or 12 weeks under certain certain conditions, and it required work. It required a lot of work. The law demands that 50% of recipients work 30 hours a week. And for two-parent families, it's 90% at 35 hours a week or so. No state can do that. It's impossible. And few recipients can do it as well. But in the early years, and this is critical, it really didn't matter. States had an escape hatch. I think of it more like the door that lets airplanes in an airport hangar. And it was called the caseload reduction credit. It reduced the state's work requirement participation rate point by point for any fall in the caseload. And that brought the effective work rate target to zero in most states in the early years. And because the law made unsubsidized employment an activity, unsubsidized employment has accounted almost from the beginning for over half of all hours of participation. Now, we all know that Congress tried to strengthen the law and the work requirements in the Deficit Reduction Act of 2005. Suddenly, no state could meet its work requirement. And that led to a renewed effort to get around the requirement and a renewed focus on the caseload reduction credit and a focus on the front door. Remember, the caseload at any point in time is a function of the entry rate, the length of stay, and the exit rate. Welfare administrators have long understood that the front door is the one thing they can control, establish a strict set of eligibility requirements, proof of residency, a home visit, a work test, apply strict redetermination visits, the caseload will fall, and it'll stay down. These rules, together with the time limit message and the hours work requirement, likely kept the caseload down during the Great Recession. So let me just end by making one sort of broad point. Obviously, there's huge variation. It's wrong to think about this as one policy. But that TANF really focused the states on dependency. They left the fight against poverty to the EITC, which meant you had to work, and to the child tax credit. But the block grant, the time limit message, the flexible MOE, the prescriptive approach to work activities meant the end of the safety net as we had known it. Spending on basic assistance in constant dollars has declined from about $30 billion in 1996 to about $8 billion today, in a rough calculation. Take-up rates among eligibles has plunged from roughly 80-some percent under AFDC to 30-some percent under TANF, but nationally, the number of children in deep poverty has risen by nearly 50%. Historically, there's been this tug of war between those who worry about dependency and those who worry about poverty. Have we struck the right balance between promoting self-sufficiency, providing an adequate safety net, and how do we think about the huge variation that's resulted out there?
Thank you. Bob?
Well, I'm going to focus my comments on two issues. One, flexibility for states under TANF. And two, is this kind of relationship with the states a model for other programs? So in a nutshell, I think there are some basic design problems in TANF where it gives states too little flexibility in terms of helping and preparing people for work, and too much flexibility in terms of the use of the dollars. States, unlike the federal government, have to balance their budgets every year, so they're constantly under fiscal pressures, and the temptation is enormous where you have a broad, flexible stream of federal money to take some of that federal money and where you can to substitute it for state dollars previously being spent on a service, which then frees up those state dollars to plug budget holes. The GAO had a report years ago finding evidence that this was happening in various areas under TANF. And you combine this issue with the fact that the federal block grant dollars have been frozen in nominal terms since 1996, causing a big erosion in purchasing power. And you put the two together, and they've contributed to a number of effects. One, as Gordon just mentioned, only 50% of federal and state TANF dollars going for the three key areas of work, child care, and basic cash assistance. And that has contributed, not the only factor, of course, to three key developments, a couple of which Gordon just alluded to. Number one, a big decrease in the share of poor children and families that receive assistance through TANF. Two, a large erosion in the benefit levels that those very poor families that do get cash assistance receive. And three, very little real help today from states to help people prepare for and get jobs, particularly the people with the greatest barriers to employment who need the most intensive but therefore the most expensive per person help. A few numbers. In the mid-90s, for every 100 poor families with children, about 70 received cash assistance through AFDC. Today, for every 100 poor families with children, only 23 get cash aid through TANF, and in some states, it's lower than 10. Benefit levels. The benefit level in most states through TANF, for those who get benefits, is below 30% of the poverty line. In 30 states, the TANF benefit level...
Keep going, just keep going.
In 30 states, the TANF benefit level is actually below half of the fair market rent, which is the basic rent for a very modest apartment. The levels are low. And as I just noted, the assistance, particularly for the people we're most concerned about at the very bottom with the biggest barriers to employment, it varies by state, to be fair, as Gordon said. But in the majority of states, not much really effective employment assistance for that group. So what does this tell you about TANF as possibly a model for other programs? Well, if you take a program like SNAP, its structure, in the absence of its structure, these problems, these shortcomings in TANF would have had graver effects. TANF hasn't been very responsive in recessions, SNAP enormously responsive. The lower the cash benefits through SNAP, through TANF, there's a partial offset and higher benefits in TANF. SNAP plays a really important role, particularly in the South, where benefit levels historically have always been lower, in lessening some of the gap in assistance relative to more affluent states in the northern part of the country. And I think of particular note is the landmark study by Hillary Hines and Diane Schenzenbach, following children from the early 70s, those in counties that had access to food stamps and other counties that didn't, and finding not just some short-term effect in terms of food on the table, but significant longer-term effects, improved school performance, an 18 percentage point higher high school graduation rate, and among girls, greater self-sufficiency and employment and earnings gains in adulthood. And this combines with the very important growing, still in an early stage, but really important research showing that very poor kids have, on average, higher levels of toxic stress that is increasingly being linked to impairments in brain development that in turn have impacts on school performance and employment and earnings in adulthood. We don't know what I'm about to say yet. It's just a plausible hypothesis. But there's a very plausible hypothesis that if we were to significantly reduce assistance for very poor kids, that you could actually end up with less employment and earnings from them when they grow up. So given all of these factors, a final comment I want to make relates to a discussion in the last panel, which is if we believe in evidence-based policymaking, we should not at this point in time be extending TANF-style work requirements to SNAP or housing programs. We have growing evidence of the importance of income and income-like support in early childhood. The Schenzenbach and Hoynes study is particularly on point with regard to SNAP. As Bob Moffitt said in the previous panel, the main result of these kinds of work requirements is to take a lot of people off the rolls. So there would be a substantial risk if you import those work requirements of many kids losing SNAP and many families losing housing assistance and potentially being at risk of homelessness. So you want to know if you're going to take those risks that you're getting big returns in response. There is a major demo underway now, and I think it's 10 states, testing various approaches to work requirements, work supports in SNAP. Congress has just enacted a major expansion of the Moving to Work demonstration for housing programs with more evaluation. The one area in housing and work where we have results is from the MDRC study on Jobs Plus, which found significant gains in what was a voluntary work program, not with work requirements. So, given that we don't have the evidence yet, and we know there are significant risks for kids, let's wait for the evidence and let those demos run rather than rushing to impose TANF-style work requirements across the safety net tomorrow.
Thank you, Bob. Raquel, please.
Good afternoon. So I'm giving a lot of thought to what I want to focus on here today, and it's really forward focus primarily, but I really want to help those who may not understand what states have been trying to do and struggling to do, I might add. First, I would like to say that we've said it, several people, about some of the work requirements and the tedious things, but it is true that it's a very real issue that there's an absolute need for states to move away from the outputs process nature of what is required in TANF today. Like, I have a staff of more than 2,000 on the front lines who are largely consumed with counting hours. And there's non-core and core, and then there's subgroups in the core and the non-core. And you can go to school for so many hours a week that you can study for a period of time, and then there's a time you study that we don't count, but if you don't study, you might not succeed in education. I'm saying that way for effect, and hopefully you felt it. And so, but the reality of it is that the staff in the human service workforce are consumed with things that don't move people forward. And so what states need is the ability and the freedom to be able to innovate as a rule and not by exception. And so that's what we face every day, and where if you could even know the specifics of what the team has to be sure they get and cover so that we don't get a penalty imposed upon us. So we spend a lot of time counting things that don't make a difference for kids and families across this country in human service. Providers across the country, both public and private, quite frankly, are coming together around these issues. The other thing that I would say is that these families, a lot of the families that we serve, have real barriers. We talk a lot about poverty, and I think someone said it earlier, but our basic premise is that very few people, if any, set out to be poor. But what we're finding in states is that families face real barriers. And by virtue of the complexity that I just described, so what I suggest to you is that I just told you what the staff have to do. I haven't told you what the people have to do. That's just what the staff have to do, not the people that we're serving, what they must do. And so the system in and of itself, to the point of toxic stress, exacerbates the pressures that families already face. And we think that when we know better, that we'll do better. So we have learned some things we knew some of some years ago, but now we know better. However, even though we've learned these things, for example, with regard to the toxic stress, and we know that according to the brain science that it has implications for executive functioning skills, which are essential for everyone to be able to be successful. But what we also know, according to the brain science, is that if you're living in a survival mode, it really does not free you up to exercise the executive functioning skills. When you face the decision of paying an electricity bill or getting a coat for your child, that's very real, and there's life after that. So those are real things that families face. But what we're excited about with regard to the future as it pertains to this issue is that what else we're learning is about the 2-gen strategy. And I know everybody says 2-gen is not new. This is true. But 2-gen done properly might be new. So 2-gen has a focus on several components, and it's not just work. It's several components. One would be education, good education, quality education, no matter the zip code. Then it would be economic supports, health and well-being, and social capital, which everybody needs in spite of socioeconomic status. Other things that we've talked about as well would be the embracing of fathers wherever they live, and whole family approach is what the 2-gen strategy is about. Learning more about it, states our position, we're interested in promising practices, and we're doing it across the country through many different ways. Ascend, APHSA, the Alliance, all working together. They put the sign up on me. The other thing I'll say really quickly, and it's rare for me to get something done in 5 minutes, but nevertheless, the fiscal cliff I have to mention. I mean, as noted, I'm a practitioner as well. I talk to families across the state of Tennessee face to face. When you have to make a decision between working part-time and full-time because you might lose a benefit, that's a real issue. And that we have a system that forces families to make those kind of choices. And that's the reality we have to accept. So in my last maybe 15 seconds, he didn't give me a 15-second sign. However, this is how I'll close. I think it's imperative that we remain mindful of systemic issues of inequality related to race, gender, disability, and other factors that create barriers for Americans living in poverty to realize their own version of the American dream. At some point, there will need to be intentional and authentic conversations regarding addressing these real issues in spite of the level of discomfort that comes with it. There's too much at stake to overlook this historical elephant that's always in the room.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
John?
I was a little worried earlier today when Daniel Lichter showed a slide about the purpose of TANF, and he then highlighted the TANF goals. I thought he was going to make a point that I wanted to make, but he didn't, so thank you. But one of the things I find it necessary to come to Washington periodically to remind you of things. And one of the things that I need to remind folks of is the what I call the long-forgotten true purpose of TANF. And because we all know from reading federal regulations that there are four purposes of TANF, and we can articulate them very well, but that's not actually statutorily correct. If you want to know what the purpose of TANF in Section 401, as Professor Lichter had up on his slide, it's in the singular. There is one purpose of TANF by the statute. Let me read it to you. This is the Personal Responsibility and Work Opportunity Reconciliation Act conference report. Section 401, purpose, A, in general, the purpose of this part, meaning Part A of the Act 4A or TANF, the purpose of this part is to increase the flexibility of states in operating a program designed to, and then it articulates four things. So the purpose of TANF is to increase the flexibility of states in order to do those certain things. So usually when we come to Washington, we understand that the only problem with these well-designed social programs is the way states mess them up. And so it's I think on the 20th anniversary, it's important to be reminded that actually state flexibility was not only a purpose, but the purpose. And we've been retrenching from that since then, so that we now have all the counting of things that go on. Most of my experience with the program was formerly working for the state of Florida, so just a couple of things primarily from a Florida perspective, that in Florida, the policy options, the state policy options that were chosen from the program largely grew out of our experience with the Family Transition Act, which was a demonstration program under one of the AFDC demonstration pilots that was rigorously evaluated by MDRC and operated primarily in Pensacola, Florida, Escambia County, which was the first time-limited welfare reform demonstration. And the policy options of strong work requirements, enhanced earnings disregard, higher asset limits, greater access to child care and enhanced funding for child care, time limits, and strong sanctions came out of that experience. Some of them were a result of findings from the evaluation, and some of them were observations from our caseworkers who said that the people that were most likely to reach the end of the time limit without a satisfactory result started in their noncompliance pattern very early on, and we needed to strengthen sanctions to get the responsibility that we wanted to see. So it came out of that, and the program largely today still mirrors those policy choices that were made. In addition, over time, The support for kin has and is an important policy goal in Florida. And one of the things that people sometimes cite as one of those other things state spends money on, supporting kin is something that's something in Florida that's done quite a bit. The other point I want to make is that you really need to disaggregate the information to really understand. For example, the perception, probably true nationally, that that during the Great Recession, that TANF was not countercyclical. That wasn't true in Florida. Actually, when the recession started really hitting Florida was in early 2007. And from April 2007 forward 3 years, the adult caseload on TANF, the number of adults on TANF, actually went up on a percentage basis greater than the SNAP caseload during that period. So there was a countercyclical effect. Interestingly, when SNAP took off and overtook was largely with the Recovery Act enhancements, and at the same time that the Recovery Act enhanced unemployment benefits were enacted. So there, and I haven't heard anything today about unemployment benefits, but that's also a kind of a, an additional factor going forward. But I think the key point is that, at least in my state, the design of the program represents clear and considered policy options by policymakers that largely have worked like the policymakers thought they would and wanted them to. The program, I do think, and particularly with the bean counting that goes on now, I think work participation rate has largely replaced AFDC error rate as sort of the counterproductive focus of a lot of administrative activity, so that I think the most innovative programs today are innovative in spite of the requirements rather than because of the requirements. And finally, I'll say going forward, three quick points. One is that our track record in Florida was never good at all with subsidized employment, but with the TANF Emergency Fund, that went in a different direction. We had some positive experiences with that, and I think that it was a shame that that went away. And going forward, I think the key questions that we have to face are, what's the best way to provide an incentive for work? Is it supplemental benefits like SNAP, Medicaid, et cetera, or EITC, or increased minimum wage, because right now we have a mishmash of all of those that don't fit together very well. And then I think the issues of asking what the most appropriate response is to the struggling or disconnected families, that's a legitimate issue, that's a real issue, and we haven't really come up with a satisfactory answer there.
Thank you, Don. Michael?
My discussion of TANF outcomes, such as Robert's earlier today, concerned how actual and potential TANF recipients respond to what states do. As a consequence, we need to think about what motivates states, and we've been doing that, and develop an idea of how TANF incentives combine with motivations to produce TANF as we have come to know it. We've heard a little bit about that. I want to talk about it. This will be the basis, I think, for predicting what happens in the future as these incentives change or if they don't. We do a couple of state models, but let's stick out one. That's the laboratories of democracy model, a really important part of the ideology behind all of this. In this model, state governments are experimentalist. There is a common national interest in providing aid to the poor, and there's a common national benefit from allowing flexibility for states to trial alternative strategies and tactics for doing so. Over time, this experiment is anticipated to clarify which strategies and tactics work best. As this knowledge is exchanged, we would expect, perhaps romantically, some convergence in procedures across states. And we would expect public support for welfare to grow because more is gained for the taxpayer's buck. An alternative model is that the central function of state government is to save taxpayers' money, and that's okay. And if there's some common national interest in providing aid to the poor, but responses to this interest by state governments are tempered by suspicion about the authenticity of need of those seeking help and concern about and lack of confidence in what other states are doing. In this model, managers get little benefit from improving either perception or accomplishment, and lack of progress erodes political support. Now, I think that a purpose behind TANF was to push for the first model, but much of the structure militates against that. As we've heard in the law cited, the 1996 law cited, among other things, four purposes for the allowance of flexibility for state government. Now, standard theory of policy says that if you've got four goals, four objectives, you need at least four instruments. So in some sense, the law placed in front of states a very interesting obligation to find things to do, and sort of at least four things, but the flexibility to do that. And they had a lot of resources, as Robert pointed out, to do it. But a concomitant problem is that the block grant created a price effect. It meant that the marginal dollar saved went into the state's general fund, or at least to a larger collection of policy, so that there was a price effect eventually acting to constrain the breadth of such activities. And it's become increasingly important. It's a TANF performance standard in the limited amount of time that I want to emphasize. And this is sort of like beating a dead horse, but let's beat it some more. The first problem with the TANF participation standard is that it focuses on process and not outcome. If we're interested in those four goals, we need to talk about what it is that's required, the ways in which that serves those goals. The architects of PRORA didn't really trust states to really make work an obligation. That's in part the obligation for that standard. But the second concern about that is that there's no basis for its value. I mean, 50% is the average participation rate requirement. If the domain is between 0 and 100 and you have no idea, you choose 50, right? And that's where we've stuck. No experimentation to think about where we might go. But the third problem, and particular, is the variation in resources. David Minnie and I have just released a paper in which we calculate the distribution, or look at the distribution of the TANF block grant and TANF plus MOE across states measured relative to the number of poor children. And we count the number of poor children with a variation in the supplemental poverty measure, accounting for other benefits and the like. From the lowest to the highest state, that ratio, that is resources provided by the program per child, varies by a factor of 8. How can you have a common performance standard and a variation of that dimension? Nobody else stopped, but I'm just going to take 1 minute more. ceding my time to Gordon, but he took it anyway. My point is that if a constraint like that, you create opportunities, you create pressures, that plus prices, to essentially go away from the glasnost. We're using Russian words now because of the role in our policy and our email, the glasnost that we need to understand what's actually happening on the ground level among states to feed into the kind of analysis that Robert's talking about. So we get many examples of essentially the expenditure of effort to play this game. The one I like, and I'm about to quit, is in California, where the way you achieve a participation rate is to establish something called a mandatory supplemental nutrition benefit, in which you look at the SNAP participants, you find the ones, families that are not on TANF, you find the ones that meet TANF standards for hours of work and have children, and you give them $10 a month. It's a mandate. It's sort of the reverse Wells Fargo effect, that instead of enrolling people with a credit card, you enroll them in TANF to bring the participation rate. Games like that are common. There's a mysterious person named Peter the Citizen who's documented a lot of them, and there's, again, on my website, there's a direction to Peter's work. So I think the focus that I would think about reinvention of TANF or extension of TANF is to find ways to create incentives to produce the information that we need to fill in the blanks that Robert so ably identified. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Mike. So I want to thank our speakers for their insightful and stimulating remarks. And what I'd like to do is begin a discussion kind of looking inward within TANF and then looking outward towards the wider safety net. And as you know, TANF reauthorization expired in 2010, and the programs continued through a series of budgetary extensions. Presumably, the next administration in Congress will take up authorization, or maybe the one after that, but hopefully the next one, okay? And that's it. It does seem like a good time to consider some of the evidence that we've heard this morning in the panels, as well as our dialogue so far in this panel, some evidence-based reforms to the program. And so I want to pick up on a couple of topics that were addressed. And this is, I think there was a bit of tension in the panel between Bob Greenstein's comments and Raquel's and Don's a little bit, and about the notion of the ability of states to innovate, you know, given that option of flexibility, and then weighed against the evidence that suggests that some states are using their TANF dollars in ways that were not originally envisioned by the Congress, so that spending levels on these core functions of cash and work and childcare are at some very low levels. And so in a recent Hamilton proposal by Marion Bittler and Hillary Hoynes, you know, they came up with several suggestions about how we might revise the TANF program, and one of those is addresses this issue, this potential issue head on, and that is whether or not states should be required to spend some minimum fraction of their block grant on these core functions of cash and childcare and work, and if so, you know, what that level should be, and should there be a performance measure associated with that? Call it an error rate for spending too little on these core functions. Okay, open that up to the panel for any comments.
I think there definitely should be a minimum percentage. My colleague Donna Pavetti is the expert on this, and I'm not, so I'm not sure exactly, you know, should it be 60%, or maybe since some states are well below it, you can't change overnight, you probably need to have a gradual path, but I think there should be a minimum percentage. But having said that, I was having a conversation with Russ Sykes about this during the break. If all you do is increase that percentage, but the federal block grant dollar amount continues on a long-term freeze, I don't think it works. I think you have to combine a minimum percentage that we move to over a few years, whatever the precise time, with some increase in the support that states are receiving. The right dollar level in 1996 can't nominally still be the dollar level that's needed in 2016.
Could I just add a little bit that you need to think also about look seriously at the numbers. If you regress, if you look at the relationship between state per capita income and both the federal block grant that's received and that plus MOE, either of them, as per capita income goes up, the federal contribution per poor child goes up. The elasticity is about 1.8. Over a percent, every percentage point as you move up the state line in terms of real per capita income, and we're talking adjustment for variation costs here, you get more money, you don't get less, and yet it would seem the lowest income state should be getting the strongest federal contribution. So in beginning this adjustment to push for income support, you have to think about varying the allocation of resources across states in ways that it's going to be probably quite politically difficult.
I think I would add that I have mixed thoughts about mandatory spending on it, particularly when it dictates where it has to be. Because families, as I indicated, have multiple barriers. And clearly, the overall outcome, what we're looking for is economic well-being. And we talked earlier, I didn't comment on this in my comments because I don't know if I have 5 minutes now or not. But what I'll say is that we keep talking about that first job when it's bigger than that. Really, we have to partner with families in a way that puts them on a path toward economic well-being. Now, what I suggest to you is what I mentioned in the two-gen strategy, that it's bigger than if we decide that the areas of focus for spending is what you narrowly describe. I would submit to you that's not sufficient when you have all these other barriers that families face. And what I think is that if the focus is more on outcomes and we're able to get at some of the other challenges, real challenges that families face that don't fall into the pie or the box or whatever is on the fiscal reporting form, then that becomes problematic. So I say wherever possible, states should be held accountable to outcomes and not have a process dictate it.
I strongly agree with that. I mean, several of you have talked about, Michael in particular, the gaming of the work participation rate, whereas if we could come up with measures that were useful on employment outcomes, that would be a better way to go. And I completely agree that for many of the poorest families, whether they have depression issues or other issues, sort of the kind of old style job training programs for someone who had a skill and that job is no longer in the economy, you need to go to that's not the kind of thing we're talking here. And so if we're talking about having a minimum percentage that states have to spend on work, cash, and child care, I think work preparation needs to be very broadly defined to include the sorts of things you're talking about. And if you really have a meaningful employment outcomes goal, then they would fit together in a meaningful way.
I just would add that it seems to me that one thing to think about is whether you want to require these dollars be targeted on the poor. The broad purposes have allowed this to get spread really way, way too thin. And I would really revisit the match versus the MOE. The whole MOE process just really sent the wrong signal, I think. You want states to have a real stake. You don't want their budget office to be challenging welfare administrators. And every one of us that were in that situation, you know, understand the problem. It was really hard to hold on to that block grant if you were the welfare administrator.
Don?
I have you know, kind of mixed feelings about it because, first of all, I do think something needs to change. And I think what happens is programs get stale over time. And it's kind of like, you know, a pier and barnacles kind of grow on it. And I think there are a lot of barnacles on the TANF program now. And I think something that refocuses would spur innovation. I'm very skeptical about, coming up with a solution of this percentage or that. I can go through the TANF budget dollar by dollar in Florida, and there are an awful lot of things. Now, some of the things that TANF has spent on came about because it is true in the late 90s, we were awash. I mean, I can remember when Florida won the first time they had high performance bonus awards, and I got the call from ACF, congratulations, Florida won a high-performance bonus. You're getting $20 million. And my first thought was, well, that's great. My second thought was, oh, my God, what am I going to spend that on? You know, we had a lot of money. And we're trying to find, you know, things to do with it that was productive. But some of those things that have lived on, if you cut them out now, I'm talking, you know, taking away mental health treatment for TANF moms that need those services to go to work. There, you know, a lot of child care stuff that gets hidden, and you know, there are several pathways to subsidize child care through TANF dollars in addition to the SSBG and CCDF transfers and all of that. So there's a lot of good stuff in there, and I think the likelihood that you would do active harm by mandating some kind of percentage is pretty dangerous.
Can I add a point? I think, maybe not, people would agree with, but particularly a question for Gordon. In the early and mid-90s, there were a lot of welfare-to-work demonstrations rigorously evaluated, and people like Ron Haskins were devouring them as he was working on the lead-up to designing the welfare law. Today, we're not learning very much from what states are doing. There aren't rigorous evaluations, and I think we would probably generally agree that one of the shortcomings of TANF is it just hasn't done a very good job with the poorest, most troubled mothers who have the most difficult time. Too many of them are disconnected, not enough of them have gone to work. We really need a new round of demonstration projects. It's not like we really know exactly what are the most effective strategies for the group that has the greatest barriers to employment. And I don't see this kind of demonstrations with rigorous evaluation coming out of the current TANF structure. I mean, if we could have an additional, wouldn't have to be a lot of money, an additional fund dedicated to a new round of demonstration projects, particularly focused on these mothers, and then hopefully we could learn things that states could pick up subsequently through their TANF programs.
Can I answer that, please? Yeah. Because I'm happy to help, so I'm from the government. So what I submit to you is that there are a lot of things going on across the country, and perhaps we haven't done a great job at publicizing that, but there's work that's being done through the APHSA, where I serve as the chair of the board there, in partnership with entities like the Ascend, with various national foundations, as well as other like the Alliance, other groups out there, both public and private, I might add, and the exact thing that you're suggesting is the exact thing that we're asking for. So if you haven't heard about it, I can make sure you hear about it. But the other issue is, it's still by exception. You know, we have to ask to be more effective. We have to get permission to innovate. When we want somebody to make a car, we don't tell them how to make it. We need a car on the other side of it. But when it comes down to helping people to make progress and move toward economic well-being, we have lots of instructions. So,
thank you. So in your various responses, there a lot of my follow-up questions were embedded with it. And so I'll try to, you know, synthesize some of those. And what I want to pick up a little bit, and this is something that Robert Moffitt talked about in the panel before lunch, where, you know, Robert thinks one of the biggest challenges for TANF right now is a block grant. And so, you know, if you inflate the $16 billion original allocation to current dollars, it'd be about a $30 billion TANF block grant today rather than $16 billion in nominal dollars. And so, you know, I want to pick up on this about kind of the success and failure of a block grant structure vis-a-vis a structure of a matching grant like the old AFDC. What do you think are kind of the advantages? What are some of the pitfalls? Some have proposed that, you know, if the block grant survives, it should be indexed to inflation. Some have proposed that there should be automatic triggers in the event of a downturn along the lines of a great recession. A couple of you have talked about the TANF Emergency Fund and how effective that was. You know, what was it within the emergency fund that allowed states to do things that are not embedded in the permanent block grant?
I would say that, first of all, at least in the short term, I thought the block grant worked great. I mean, because if you had had, and I don't think you would have had the caseload reduction that we had, but perhaps just if there had not been changes in AFDC, but if you'd had that, think of the amount of federal money, matching money, and state money that would have gone away. So I think that even though the MOE was just 80%, it's a pretty darn effective MOE construct. I mean, it's... Once you kind of mine all of the nooks and crannies that you can mine, and once you kind of plumb that, then it becomes pretty darn hard to get around that MOE requirement. And with the federal dollars, was very effective. Over time, now it's whittled. One of the things that has hit particularly my state very hard and some other states was the loss of the TANF supplemental grant. That was $319 million. Florida was $62 million. I think so. When we lost that, that was a big hit initially. So there have been some hits, but there would have been, the matching arrangement is There are downsides to matching arrangements also, and part of it is matching for what and what kinds of expenditures you match. So I think that certainly it, increasingly having a block grant that is based on nominal 1996 dollars makes less and less sense. But if you could fix that, I think that the overall structure of the block grant, there's a lot of benefits to it.
But it's not just inflation that we're after. It's the changing distribution of the number of poor families. So you have to move beyond that a certain extent. And I also think, again, we're getting at this price effect. Some of the things that we want states to do have spillover benefits. If Tennessee does something that's really productive and as rigorously evaluated as in the course of their management, we're all going to benefit so that the return or the, at least the adoption of a strategy for promoting, getting back to the laboratories, as I was discussing earlier, requires thinking about how you subsidize those sorts of activities. One of the tragedies of PRORA, I think, has been the demise of state analysis offices. Used to be, most states had within the secretary's office several people whose job was policy analysis, was learning elsewhere, thinking about the implications. Sometimes they were good, sometimes they were bad, but those people's salaries cost 50 cents on the dollar. Their price was doubled by this reform, and yet we were expecting research. So we have to think about a new administrative structure for addressing that.
But those people still, if those people existed, and I think with state budget cutbacks they have been lessened, but you still get almost 50 cents on the dollar because those people are cost allocated among SNAP, Medicaid, and TANF, and the SNAP and the Medicaid are so big relative to the TANF, it's still 50 cents on the dollar.
I think the...
you had to explain that.
The politics are that the block grant's here to stay. I don't think we're going back in TANF to a matching structure. And if the block grant is here to stay, surely there are things to do to make the problematic aspects, and I think there are aspects that are inherently problematic, less so. But the larger lesson, I think, is we never should have done this as a block grant in the first place, and we shouldn't apply the model to other programs. It is very difficult to draw the MOE and all those requirements so tightly that there isn't a little bit in states that really press the envelope of using it as a bit of a slush fund where it disappears in other parts of the budget. TANF did not perform well in the recession. Don's state of Florida is a notable exception because Florida made the very wise decision to essentially run TANF through its state budget as an entitlement so that when the economy went down and more people became eligible, the state dollars went up. But that wasn't typical. So you had states like Washington, not a deep red state in the South, that faced with rising caseloads shortened the time limits a lot, or states like Oregon that faced with rising caseloads decimated their work programs. And in theory, you could design a formula to try and have the block grant dollars go up in recessions, but no one has ever designed a formula that really effectively matches increases in need and in real time. We have lags of data for many months and all the key economic and other variables that you would need. Beyond that, block grants do very poorly in federal funding competition. We recently did an analysis of every major social service program block grant in the recent history of the country. And if you look at them from 2000 to 2016, they declined 27% in real terms. They just don't do well for various reasons I don't have time to go into in the funding.
Speaking of time, we're almost done. So
the last thing I want to say is you could get a bunch of the benefits and of the innovation and flexibility that TANF provided within a matching structure, particularly if you allow a lot of waivers, like states got to experiment and do various things in the early 90s. And in this vein, I want to second Michael, something Michael said about his website. Anybody in the room who is really interested and serious about TANF should go on Michael Wiseman's website and read the important papers by Peter the Citizen.
We have time for...
You can actually read some papers by me, too, please.
we have time for one question before we break. All right, Russ.
First of all, I appreciate the comments that Bob made about the fact that the block grant has lost so much money. What would the panel think about if you had restrictions on money, that it be on new money and not on the basic 16-plus billion? In other words, if we could get $3-4 billion added and restrict it to purposes similar to what was done under IRA and some other things, particularly about employment and child care.
Well, at a minimum, you'd have to prevent erosion of the existing money, or you could just take the new money, substitute it for the old money, and not make any difference.
So I just would say, look, it would be politically expedient. You know, it's the perfect compromise. You could probably maybe even get away with it. But the deeper question, it seems to me, is do we think we really need a cash assistance program as a true safety net? We don't really have one right now. And if you don't do something more along those lines, we're not going to have one. And how do we feel about that as a society?
I would agree with that. Cash in most of the world is pretty cool.
And on that note, so we're at the end of our panel. First of all, I would want to thank all the staff here at Brookings who have helped organize this event today. I want to, in particular, thank Emily Bowden for all the work that she did on our behalf and setting up today's conference, and also Jeff Spradling at the University of Kentucky Center for Poverty Research. So let's give all those who have helped set this up today.